Welcome to another episode of Policy Talks. Today we have a celebrated international best-selling author, Richard Turin, with us. He's the author of Cashless, China's Digital Currency Revolution, and Innovation Lab Excellence. So there is a fair degree of, you might say, coalescing of thoughts, because CIPP, as all of you who have been following us, has been advocating for CBDC for now more than 2 years, and we stand for innovation. Welcome to the show, Richard. Good to have you here.
Hi, Atisha. Thank you so much for having me. And a hello to everybody out there in podcast and video land. Thanks for watching or listening.
Okay. So, Richard, my first question, of course, is, you know, you must have observed that in the last 3 months or so, RBI has announced a fairly detailed plan, both for the rollout of wholesale CBDCs and retail CBDCs. Overall, also, as you know, that almost every country that is part of BIS has some roadmap of sorts for a CBDC rollout. So can you put this CBDC rollouts across the world into context in a global payment scenario?
Boy, okay, so we're starting with the big questions.
Yes.
So let's go global and let's look at what China can potentially add to this conversation. So you're right. Number one, 90% of the world's central banks right now, and it represents some 95% of global GDP, are in various stages of investigating central bank digital currencies, or CBDCs. So we're looking at a transformation, a disruption of the cash systems and how we pay, both on retail level, that is between person and person, or person and store locally, domestically, but also on a global scale, how we make cross-border transfers. So big changes coming up. And of course, China was the first major industrialized nation to go to trial with its central bank digital currency. So the question that really comes out of this is, what does China, the most advanced country, what can they do to help those who are coming from behind? And I think the best answer is that these countries should be as meticulous as China. Because if you look at China's trial period for the central bank digital currency,
it's very slow. They took 7 years.
It's slow. Yeah. You see, that's the point. And that's wonderful. It's this long stage. They started researching it back in 2014.
Yeah.
At the same time as the launch of WeChat Pay and Alipay in China. So you've got this long development cycle. And it's not because China is slow. China is a fast digital country.
Absolutely.
But what you're looking at is a replumbing, changing the pipes of the entire monetary system in a nation. And it has to be done very thoughtfully, very meticulously. There is no room, as we see right now in the crypto world, for do-overs or errors. It has to work right the first time. So what China can add to this discussion is this whole concept of be meticulous.
Tell us a little bit about, why did China take 7 years to actually roll out, and it is still in the trial phase, the digital yuan, as it is called. What did they learn? Is there a particular method I don't know much about how CBDC has been rolled out in China in the, you know, 17 odd cities that they are planning to roll it out. But what are they exactly doing?
Sure. And let's put this in real solid, let's explain this in really solid terms so that everybody gets this.
Yeah.
And I'm going to put it in terms of two different payment systems. One is Bitcoin, and the other is the payment systems WeChat Pay and Alipay in China. The first one is Bitcoin. You invent Bitcoin. You put it out there and you say, people, Do with it what you want. You design the wallets. You design the various systems for exchanges or whatever. It's thrown out there and people, you design this ecosystem to go with it. So the launch of Bitcoin could be very relatively quick because all they had to do is make the coin. So cryptocurrency, cryptocurrency is easy. You make a coin and you throw it out there. Well, look, when China makes the digital yuan, it can't just throw it out there and say, hey, everybody, you figure out how to use it. It has to be tightly integrated into society so that when somebody goes to use the digital yuan on a bus, they put their phone on the bus and it receiver and it works. But then you have to ask these terribly detailed questions. How do you pay for a bus in your city or province today? How digital is that? Is it with paper tickets? Is it with a digital reader? Can the digital reader accept the digital yuan? You know, there are all of these really ultra detailed questions that you need answers for before you say, hello world, we've got the digital yuan, please use it. And that's and that really speaks to why it continues to be a long process for rollout in China.
So what you're telling me is that they needed a digital payment system first, and after that they wanted to roll out the currency, which would act as the, you know, the value of exchange in that payment system. Now, India adopted a different route, so to say. We, as you know, introduced 7 years back, around 6.5 years back, we introduced UPI, which is the Unified Payment Interface, which is a digital public good. It is not owned by the government. It is owned by an entity which is just partly owned by the central bank and other banks. And it can be used by any payment wallet or any bank by simple interfaces like a QR code or even a URL. So as you know that this helped India kind of leapfrog not only existing payment systems of credit cards and banking system, it also allowed India to leapfrog and do the penetration much better in rural areas and for small transactions, because they kept the interface fee as zero. Now they are rolling out the first stage, is the rollout of the wholesale CBDC. This scenario, can you compare this scenario, say, with Europe or with US or with China? And tell us what is the difference and what is the benefit or the pros and cons in each of these scenarios, if possible.
Sure. First, let me say, without any hesitation, the Reserve Bank of India, the RBI, was so advanced and should be congratulated for the fabulous success that is UPI. UPI made digital payment a public good in India, and that direction, the way that they thought of digital payment as being infrastructure, part like roads, bridges, tunnels, a public service, is groundbreaking. And it's exactly the opposite of how, say, the United States thinks of digital payment. So if you look at the US right now, there's a big debate of, well, what is digital payment? What is central bank digital currency? Why do we need one? We have Visa and MasterCard, that's digital enough. And of course, Visa and MasterCard charge all citizens a percentage to use the card. You get it in what's called interchange fees. And then on top of that, there are fees to the merchant, the store that uses it. So besides the other problems, it's that payment is seen as a private sector initiative in the United States and not a public good as it is in India, and as it is also thought of in the EU, where in Europe right now, they're hard at work at building a digital euro, which is good. Now, China's sort of interesting. China clearly thinks of digital payment as a public good when you look at its experience building the central bank digital currency. But the question comes, how did China think about it back in 2014 when WeChat Pay and Alipay were given cash transmission licenses and banking licenses? Okay. So at that point in 2014, the digital companies, private digital companies of WeChat or Tencent and Alibaba, which launched Alipay, were far beyond technologically what the central bank could do. So I think what you saw in China was an acknowledgement. The banks were all state banks. There were no private banks back in 2010 through 14, in the early days when they just started working on WeChat Pay and Alipay. So the thought was, let the private sector do this, just as because we, the public sector, the central bank, is really, we're really not equipped. And I think that's why you saw the central bank start what's called the Digital Currency Research Institute the same year that WeChat Pay and Alipay launched. They figured out, hey, this is something we have to catch up with. So it's really fascinating to see the transition and how China thinks about it. But I have to say that the RBI really was technologically at the right spot, and the way they visualized digital payments' role in society as a public good was a breakthrough then, and continues to be a breakthrough. I give them tremendous credit. Now, taking it one step further to go to central bank digital currency, I am deeply in reverence of the RBI for having such forethought.
So now what happens, that because India created this digital public infrastructure as a public good, the capacity, and it is now looking at, as you know, UPI is being adopted in some 30, 40 countries, which have basically taken the technological stack and they're using it for their own internal, it's an open source, so anybody can take it, even China can take it if it wants to. The interesting thing now, the interesting question here is that, and this is something that I have also tried to understand and failed to, what will be the role of banks, especially global foreign banks, when CBDC, which is rolls out for wholesale banking? As you know that in global trade, the highest cost of global trade is foreign exchange conversion and global transaction fees. I mean, there are reports which say that it is as high as 8% to 14%. Now, these are very high costs. So what will happen? And these are the reason that global foreign banks dominate the so-called global banking or global fintech industry, so to say. That's why fintech has not been able to reach out and, you know, take the space of these global payments. How do you see CBDC affecting banks, foreign banks, in wholesale banking particularly?
Sure. Let me divide that question into two parts. The first part will be very short, and that will be to talk about domestic banks. First of all, the concept that somehow central bank digital currency will take all of the reserves out of the bank and destabilize the banking system is complete nonsense. Okay, we've got lots of studies out there that have shown that this simply will not happen. Plus, central bank digital currencies in most rollouts in the world, including China's, have limits on how much you can transfer from your bank to the central bank digital currency and payment limits. So the thought that you're going to take $1 million out of your bank account, put it into central bank digital currency and spend it as a private citizen, a corporate might be able to do that, but a private citizen is not going to be able to do that. So number one, central bank digital currencies are not going to take reserves out of the banking system and destabilize them. Number two, and this is far bigger, you're going to hit, when you talk about digital central bank digital currency transfers across borders, you're going to hit on two big subjects, three actually. One, SWIFT, the use of the SWIFT currency system. Two, the use of the dollar, because the dollar and SWIFT are a matched pair. They go together for most cross-border transfers. And three, and this is a topic of our times, sanctions. So the questions that really are hot on everybody's mind right now are, number one, cross-border transfers. Yes, I believe thoroughly that central bank digital currency will be used in cross-border transfers within the next year to 2 years. Give it a year, sometime in that 13 to 18 month period, you're going to see it used. Why? Very simple. BRICS nations, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, all are building central bank digital currencies. All of them within the next 18 months are going to be in various stages of usability. And to go with that, we have something in Hong Kong called M-Bridge. And if you don't know about it, you know, it's something that all of your fans should research. But it's the Hong Kong Monetary Authority and five other central banks, not all BRICS banks, but still, they've designed a foreign exchange platform specifically for central banks. So we're going to have the digital currencies in the BRICS nations. We're going to have the transfer agent in Hong Kong. It's happening. Now, next question. De-dollarization? Yes. Yeah. Destruction, ready? Toppling of the dollar? No. Destruction of dollar? No. A gentle, very, very slight and gradual, like a slow leak, a drip from a big pot, water in a pot, and you've got a slow leak, right? A slow but steady de-dollarization as money goes on to direct central bank digital currency transfers and sanctions. Very hard. That's all. I'll let you ask more about that. But all I'm going to say is that whether you like sanctions, support them, or don't support sanctions, in the central bank digital currency world, they will be very, very difficult, next to impossible for one nation to sanction globally all other nations. That's gone.
So interesting you put it into these three buckets. And my next question is about the second bucket and the third bucket, which is the dollar, the role of dollar in the CBDC world. You're saying that it will go down slowly. It will not change overnight, but it will certainly, one of the costs of transaction of global trade is that your currency changes into dollar first, and then it changes back into the local currency of that country. So if you were buying oil from Nigeria, you would change first into dollar, and then it will change into Naira, and then it will change back, you know. So the cost of transaction or the foreign exchange transaction cost, therefore, increasing substantially. In the CBDC world, the foreign exchange transaction cost becomes exactly the conversion cost or the currency costs in the market. Now, this is said to be both beneficial to trade in the sense that it will help exporters or companies to trade better and get better margin. But how will it affect foreign banks who have bulk of their profits coming from this foreign exchange conversion or foreign exchange trade?
First of all, your explanation was perfect. And you highlighted the big problem, which is that most developing nations have what's called a double jump or a double hit of the foreign exchange platform from native currency to dollar and then dollar to something else. It's tremendously expensive. And with the rise in the dollar's valuation due to the interest rate rises, most of the emerging markets right now are struggling with food insecurity, because commodity and food prices are all based in dollars. So what is going to happen is this slow but steady revaluation in direct emerging market or developing nation currency to other currency and without the dollar as this intermediary. And that's revolutionary. Now, what happens to the banks?
Yeah,
for that,
foreign banks.
I think, right. And for that, I'm going to go back to the domestic example. What happened in China when WeChat Pay and Alipay became the dominant means of payment? Well, very simple. If you were running a credit card payment business in a bank in 2013, people were buying more cards, everything was great. You were making more money on card fees every year. The future looked endless because China was gaining more money and everything was going up. After WeChat Pay and Alipay hit, suddenly people stopped using their cards and the card fees to banks were decimated. Billions of dollars lost. There are big estimates of how much per year, some as much as $6 billion. Anyway, same with the international banks. It's not going to come all at once, but the fees that global banks took from foreign exchange, from serving as a correspondent bank, for waiting and holding your money, all of that's gone. Direct, immediate payment changes the payment game, and it is no longer reasonable to assume that banks can continue to have high profits from these cash transfer profit centers. It's over. Not immediately, it will be gradual, but it is a sunsetting business. It's going to slowly die.
Let's shift gears a little bit here now and go again back to the macro scenario. You know, you've written extensively on the digitization of payment systems and cash and currency per se. What is your view of digitization of the economy per se, one, its impact on other institutions like democratic institutions, or specifically, like, for instance, take the impact of social media on both mental health, narratives, and society at large? How do you see that part of digitization playing out?
Look, that's the biggest question that the entire planet is trying to deal with right now, is what role does digital play in our lives and how do we control that? And that comes both with social media, fake news, digital privacy. So we are really in the beginning. Now I have to put on my innovator's hat more than my engineering central bank digital currency hat right now, because we have to think of ourselves as still being at the very beginning of this societal digital transformation. Even though we think that what we've got with internet or whatever is pretty high tech, compared to what we're going to see in the next 50 years, it's nothing. So I think that the big problem that we need to deal with is to define and codify into law, what is digital privacy? What rights do we have with respect to artificial intelligence and algorithms that decide whether we get a loan? What we now have algorithms that determine your fate in the world, whether it's loans, what you see when you want to buy something at an Amazon, So we have to start to codify into law these things. And now, this is controversial. China is the first nation in the world and has the strictest digital privacy laws in the planet. They also have laws on anti-monopoly. What's the role of a digital service like Facebook? Are they allowed to be? Facebook is a monopoly. There's nobody else on the planet who can compare. Do they have the right to be a monopoly in India? Do they have the right to send Indian data offshore? These are real fundamental questions. So we hit it in the central bank digital currency world as well, because we ask the fundamental question, what is your right to privacy for payments? And anybody who uses cash feels that my payments are 100% private. I pay, that's done. And if you pay in suitcases full of money, that's bad because you're avoiding taxes. So we have already this concept that low value payments are private, high value payments are the open to the state. And I know that's controversial. And that's the general way that central bank digital currency is dealing with this concept of digital privacy and how does it fit into the new digital society.
So interesting scenario. Let me put this, pull it back into one specific area, which is social media. We have Facebook, which is fully owned, and it, the shares are structured in a manner that it is fully owned by one individual. That nobody else has the voting rights in that company to control that company. Similarly, now we have another company in social media, which is now privately held by Elon Musk. So we have two large social media companies, almost like duopolies in social media space, controlled by two individuals who can therefore, technically can shape global narratives, shape local narratives, shape national narratives, and impact societies across the world. So do you see these duopolies or monopolies in their own sphere getting under higher scrutiny and getting possibly regulated or broken down in your worldview?
Absolutely. Antitrust measures are coming for Facebook and many of the other big techs in the U.S., and perhaps for just as they've come for China. China's antitrust laws are strict.
And China's antitrust laws are very different from the antitrust laws in the rest of the world, in the sense that it is not based upon the biggest profit-making or price gouging by the monopoly. Am I correct?
Oh, that's correct. So look, antitrust was the big issue that came with the Ant Group IPO of 2020. Now I have to think how many years, 2020. So what you really looked at was what is the right of an individual company to control a sector, whether it's in China, the US, or any place else. And so in my view, the US big techs are ripe for antitrust in the United States. And remember, the United States is the country that broke up the Bell telephone system with antitrust back in the early 80s, if memory is right for the date. But the point is, the US has done this before. So will it do it again? So here's the arguments right now. Big tech is telling the US government, you need us for further innovation to combat China's fantastic digital leaps.
Is that the argument?
And that's what big tech is telling government. And then other people like me are saying, big tech, you have done nothing but buy smaller tech companies and bury their technology for fear that they would replace you. And the best possible example is Facebook buying WhatsApp. That was insane, and it would never happen today, but when it went through a number of years ago, it was considered an okay deal. But, you know, so antitrust with social media, yes, I'm all for it. The other thing that's going to rise and will not be, so I'm talking about a process that is U.S. controlled, but there are processes that are domain to India and every sovereign nation, which is the question of who has your data and do they have the right to transport that data across national borders, data sovereignty. And that's a strong position for China. And I think that you're going to see other nations take that same step to say, okay, certain data can be transported, but other data cannot. And that's going to change the whole social media space, but it's not going to be immediate. This is still going to be some years off.
Yeah, I know. So data liberalization is something that, you know, India has been thinking about, but the new Data Protection Act that has come out, it's actually a draft is out now. And that is actually moving away from data localization because it feels that it becomes too restrictive. I don't know exactly what reason they have given for moving away from data localization, but they have said that they will not be pursuing data localization. So do you think data localization per se will change the dominance of platforms in social media or e-commerce or any other space? Or is there, I mean, is that enough?
Well, certainly for social media, it would be a big change in their business model. And it would be a significant change in data privacy. Who has your data? Where is it going? Here's the reality. As soon as data leaves your national boundaries, we don't know where it goes. And in fact, more often than not, particularly on social media, it goes to data brokers who sell your data, who profit on your data. Now, we can get into the discussion of whether that's right or wrong, but the reality is better control of data and segregating data that can be shared globally or data that is considered sensitive and must stay in country, like bank account, like payment information. So we get back to CBDC, all right? Nobody wants a central bank digital currency with shared platform, you know, with shared offshore data storage. You know, that's not going to be, you know, if any central bank, no central bank wants to do that, I guarantee you. But the point is that would not be saleable. So I think most people agree that there's certainly data that needs to be localized and highly private and not subject to offshore, being sent offshore.
Let me bring you back to another one of your favorite areas. The rise of CBDC and the death of crypto. These are almost parallel changes in that sense. I mean, they say one is leading to the death of other. And I believe that, I call crypto a Cartesian asset because it has no inherent value. Its value is only in trade, and its value and the trade's value is also derived from it being seen, you know, very like a reality star who does not have any talent, but is still a global phenomenon.
I'm sorry, that's just brilliant. Thank you so much. You made my afternoon.
But at the other end, you have a currency which actually has inherent value because it is a fiat which is issued by the central bank, and it is now going digital. And so how do you see this, the death of crypto and the rise of CBDC, say in the next 9 months to 12 months, you know, how do you see it panning out?
Okay, so before I answer this question, I'm going to make a pause to say something nice about crypto.
Okay.
Because what follows afterwards may not always be nice.
Okay.
We all owe crypto a debt of gratitude. Mm-hmm. And I mean that. Crypto is the very technology that's the foundation of central bank digital currency. Crypto forced traditional banking and financial institutions to reevaluate their cash transfer policies, their charges, their fees. So we owe, love it or hate it, it is a fact that they are helping to push change. And for that, I am genuinely grateful, and I tell other people we should be genuinely grateful to these innovators because they are true innovators. End of first part. Now to the next part. I have zero tolerance for cryptocurrencies, theft, fraud, blatant abuse of trust of the public, social media influencers who are paid to promote coins, an ecosystem that is so full of fraud, it should disgust everyone. And I'm sure after the most recent crash of FTX, many hardcore crypto supporters are crushed. But the reality is, without regulation, people do not, without regulation, it is not good to assume that people will be good and do the right thing. Regulations are required for crypto, for banking, because people over past centuries have been stealing money. It's not new. So the assumption that crypto is somehow should remain unregulated is absolutely insane. And the end game is regulated crypto that has regulated exchanges that have to prove that they actually have reserves, crypto transfers that actually have people paying taxes on them because we like things like airports and hospitals and roads, which are all built as public goods, but they are paid for with public money. So I don't see crypto dying, mm-hmm. but I do see a great transformation toward regulation. And in the end, crypto's narrative of being decentralized, which is true as far as the actual machinery goes, the technology is decentralized, but in practical terms, it will not be this decentralized world because you will have to tell the exchange who you are. You'll have KYC, you know your customer, you'll have AML, anti-money laundering. All of these things will be part of the next generation of crypto exchanges and other crypto ecosystems partners. So it's going to be not too dissimilar from Visa, MasterCard, and central bank digital currency, all of which have similar characteristics.
So you're saying that the end game for crypto is it morphing into more recognized method of exchange and following all the regulations or some of the new regulations like AML, KYC, the exchange itself being regulated, the ownership of the exchange being regulated, who owns that exchange, and maybe, you know, a transaction guarantee of crypto.
Yeah, those are all perfectly reasonable scenario things. Look, we know about money today. It's not that cross-border, we don't like the cross-border transfer system that we currently have with banks. It's expensive, it's slow, it's bad. No argument about it. But we do know that that system has some requirements associated with it. And those requirements are, we have to know who you are to access the system.
Yeah.
And we have to know where the money is going. So that's not exactly new. These are, you know, these are things that have been around probably for thousands of years. You can look back into older texts, whether it's Confucian, Hindi, or wherever, they're there. Knowing where the money is going is not a new concept. That you can build a new digital system that doesn't tell you where the money is going is true. We have it. We have crypto. And some people want that. But the reality is it will be brought back into more traditional space where we have to know who is getting the money and where it's going and why. And for ready for one reason, people don't want to pay taxes. They really don't. So, you know, a lot of crypto right now, you know, a lot of, you know, the Internal Revenue Service in the United States, and of course the same tax organizations in China are going after all of these crypto accounts by what are called high rollers or whales who have very large crypto transactions that they have historically not paid money for, taxes for, sorry, in the US and in China because they've moved money illegally out of the country, ignoring the currency transfer restrictions. So it's really, it's not looking good for crypto. It will exist, but it's not looking good for those who believe in free money that is without regulation. That model is over.
So the decentralized finance will come back into centralized finance. Now let me.
DeFi is a great example. Ready? It's not DeFi anymore. What you're going to see is permissioned DeFi. Permission because we have to know who you are before you access the DeFi exchange or currency bridge or whatever it is. And the DeFi, the functionality is fantastic. Banks, major institutions are going to use permissioned DeFi in the next 5 years. Some are already starting to work with it. So yeah, it's a great technology, but permissioned.
Permission DeFi. Now let's go a little deeper into the smartness of the CBDC. One of the key elements of any digital asset is the fact that it is it can be programmed, it can have memory embedded on it, it can have transaction history embedded in it, it can roll out or roll in depending upon that intelligence. So basically, you know, when we talk about central bank digital currency or when we were talking about crypto, we were talking about the digital asset having intelligence. And based on that intelligence, you could structure smart contracts. And that now with CBDC seems like a real possibility. The technology exists in blockchain, the technology exists, the system also exists, but it was just waiting for CBDC to happen. How much smartness do you foresee coming into transactions over the next 12 to 18 months or longer, if you have a view?
I think we have to look longer term for it. So right now in China, the government has just started experimenting with smart contracts, and they are likely to be rolled out after the rollout of the official rollout of the central bank digital currency, because they are potentially problematic in that they are so powerful that they can be used for good or bad. So what you're going to see is a very careful use of smart contracts in the China context, and also in the world. But let's look at smart contracts for a second.
Yeah.
People are of two minds about smart contracts, and this is going to be fun. In one mind, people think of smart contracts as being the end of freedom, because they think of a smart contract in terms of my digital dollar, digital rupee, will be canceled if I don't use it in 18 months, unlike a banknote, which is forever, right? Mm-hmm. Or they think in terms of, you'll hear this all the time about central bank digital currency, the government is going to tell me what I can or cannot spend my money on.
Yep.
Ready? So that's the one side of the programmable money debate. And now let's look at the other side of the programmable money debate.
Yeah.
Let's look at the United States, which for social assistance programs gives out many millions of debit cards. And you know what? These debit cards, the money on them expires after 6 months. And you know what? The money on those cards can't be used at an alcohol shop or maybe a gun store. The point is, we already have programmable money of a form, and that form is through debit cards. And you can look. Now, if you ask people in the United States, do you want social assistance programs that give money so that people can buy alcohol or guns with the money? And the obvious answer would be no. So if you ask them, do you think it's good that these debit cards have a limit? Of course, they're going to say yes, right? But on the other hand, when they look at CBDC, they say, oh my God, programmability. It's the end of freedom. And that's my favorite line, because that one always pops up in some very radical programmability, anti-programmability writing. So the answer is programmability is generally good. It is a necessary feature. Within the next decade, it will be everywhere. And the reason is because you need programmability, not because you need it, but you know who needs it? Machines. And when you talk about central bank digital currency, and when you look into our future, you're looking at a future where your car will pay, an industrial machine will receive payment after making half of its production allotment for a progress payment. So you're going to connect payments to a machine-based system. So programmable money is going to be everywhere.
So why hasn't the machine-to-machine transaction? That's a brilliant, brilliant analogy, Richard, because that explains why programmable money is, CBDC or all digital currencies, actually nothing else but programmable money. But the word programmable money, Richard, has just not caught on. CBDC has caught on.
It really brings fear into many people. because they don't really realize. They don't realize. Okay, most people, especially if you go to the euro and U.S. zone, are the majority of their payments are already on debit or credit cards.
Yeah.
And whether you like it or not, you know, and this goes back to our social discussion about society. What about our digital society? Whether they like it or not, certain banks in the United States will not let you take your debit card and buy guns or pornography with that card. That's already programmed money. But it's interesting. It's not programmed by the government. It's programmed by a private corporation who determines what. So in a way, that's even more dystopian. So, you know, so it's really funny because we have to really break it down. We have to break down privacy and programmability and the discussion about CBDC with the real understanding of what you have now. Let me give you an example. The biggest issue about CBDC, people will say this, the government can shut down my money. I don't want central bank digital currency. Please tell me you haven't heard that, right? That's common. Go to Canada, go to last spring, go to the trucker strike, where 300 plus bank accounts were shut by the Canadian government. The Canadian government is hardly a totalitarian regime. All right, but they were able to close some 350 different bank accounts for various truckers. They later reopened them and said they were sorry. But the point is, don't tell me about central bank digital currency being able to, quote, close, shut down your money, whether it's the Internal Revenue Service in the United States or central various security agents. They can shut them down now without no CBDC required.
If you commit a financial crime or if you commit a certain crime, your accounts can be frozen in India too.
You have to get a warrant. There's a process to doing this, but the reality is, if you look at our current system, here's what I like to say. Central bank digital currency does not really give the government superpowers over your money compared to the powers that they already have over the banking system through the police and other legal entities. Sorry, that's just the reality. People want to make it seem like central bank digital currency is this new, has superpowers like Superman, you know? No, it doesn't.
Thank you very much, Richard. I mean, this has been enlightening. It has been enriching. It has been very useful. And I'm sure viewers who will be seeing this will get a completely different view about how CBDC, how digitization, and how the larger macro environment around payments is moving. Thank you very much again.
Yitesh, thank you so much for having me, Yitesh. Look, it's wonderful being here. Please, everybody out there in the audience, your central bank digital currency future is a good one. Look forward to it. It's a great advance. You should be proud of the RBI in particular for having the vision to create the central bank digital currency. And again, if you're interested in China and China's central bank digital currency, or if you disagree with anything that I've said and want to write out to me, please, I'm on LinkedIn and I'm on Twitter all the time. Please write to me. I have to say this, I'm an author, forgive me. My book, okay, which you see by my head, is available on Amazon and other digital platforms, Kobo, a whole bunch of them, I don't remember them all. But most importantly, our digital future is a good one. And it's something to look forward to. And CBDCs are going to be a great part of that future.
Thank you, Richard.